Willard Spiegelman's new book, Senior Moments, Looking Back, Looking Ahead, is a reflection on growing older, that unavoidable and universal fate. The book gathers more than six decades of lessons from Spiegelman's career as a writer and a professor. Humorous and sophisticated, the book is a series of discrete essays that, when taken together, depict the life of a man who, despite Western cultural notions of aging as something to be denied, overcome, or resisted, has continued to relish the simplest of pleasures, reading, looking at art, conversing, and remembering in occasional fits of nostalgia while also welcoming what inevitably lies ahead. Again, the name of the new book is Senior Moments, Looking Back, Looking Ahead. Willard Spiegelman is the Hughes Professor of English at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure as well.
What was it in you that wanted to tackle this topic and to put this particular book together?
Actually, I had no intention of either growing old or writing about growing old, but they both seem to have happened. Let me tell you how the book got into its shape. I write essays. I like writing essays. And I had written a couple of essays. The first one was about living in Dallas, Texas, where I've been for 45 years, and a couple of others. And these were all published in literary quarterlies. And then I took it into my mind to think whether I could weave everything into a book. I had a previous book of essays also published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux called Seven Pleasures, Essays on Ordinary Happiness. And I had maybe three or four of these essays, and I asked my editor whether I could expand them. And he said, sure, go ahead. Try to weave some thread through all of it. So I did, and I wrote some new essays and expanded the ones I had. And the book goes from, quite deliberately, the first chapter is called Talk, and it starts with me as a precocious talker, and it ends with silence or quiet, which is the trajectory that all of our lives take. We come into the world with a cry, and we go out to confront the final silence. So I put together these essays. I'll tell you the order that they're in. It's a kind of deliberate order. Talk comes first, then Dallas, which is where I've lived for 45 years, then an essay called Japan, about going for the only time in my life to a country where I could not understand or read or utter a single word of the language, which is a very humbling and exciting experience. And then the fourth chapter is called Manhattan, about deciding as a senior citizen to get a toehold in New York, which I think is the best place to be an old person, though I don't think I'm old yet. And then a chapter called Books, about what it's like as a reader to change your reading habits as you get older and you need bigger print and brighter light and your tastes change. And then a chapter called Art, about what it's like to be in museums, which is sometimes unpleasant. And then a chapter called Nostalgia, that's the looking back part, about going to my 50th high school reunion. And then the last chapter on quiet, which was originally an essay called Some Words on Silence. As you get older, you look for more silent places. And this was, I think, based on an essay I wrote called Noisy Restaurants. I think there are only noisy restaurants left these days. Anyway, that's the trajectory of the book, and that's how it got licked into shape.
You said just a moment ago that you don't consider yourself old yet. Is that a number, or is that how you are feeling, do you think?
Somebody wants to define middle age, and you might say this of old age too. Middle age or old age is 5 years older than you are at the present.
Okay.
But I think it's a matter of feeling. You know, I'm aware that certain parts of my body don't work as well as they used to. And I'm aware that some kinds of mental acuity are not as strong as they used to be. But I think just genetically, I'm predisposed to being a happy, cheerful person, and I've had the good luck of not having had any bad health. I'm knocking on wood right now. So, you know, the one thing that we all have in common is that we're all going to die. And I find that kind of implausible, but I know it's true.
You talk in that first essay, Talk, about conversation and refer to it as the essential human art. How so?
It's what brings us together. I mean, we have animal instincts, of course, and there's sex and there's love and there are bodily needs. But I think what makes society what it is the art of human beings getting to know one another. And we do that mostly through conversation.
exploring that in the sense of aging, how do you think our conversations change? Do they become more important, more interesting, have more weight to them?
That's an interesting question, and it's something I was very aware of. When I was a small boy, and I had lots of great aunts and uncles and all of the sisters and brothers of my grandparents and an extended family, I was very alert to the fact that everybody was talking all the time. And these were what I thought were old people. 10 years later or so, when I got to be a teenager, and those same voluble elders had become 10 or 12 years older themselves, I noticed they were talking less. And I think that as you get older, you are more contented with quieter conversations. You know, young people are promiscuous in all kinds of interesting ways. And I always tell students, I'm not going to tell you what to read. You should read promiscuously, as I did. And young people are voluble, and young people are active. And I think older people slow down, and I think conversations become slower, but more meaningful, perhaps. One of the things I notice, and I think everybody notices this, if you're out in a restaurant and you see a middle-aged married couple or an older married couple sitting there without talking to one another, I remember as a young man thinking, how sad, how sorry. They don't have any inner resources. They have nothing to say to one another. Life is over for them. But, you know, now I realize you can sit in silence with a partner and not have to say anything. You can have unembarrassed silences because there's not that much left to be said.
In your essay entitled Dallas, you say, here is a formula for staying young well beyond the days of youth. Grow old in a place where you do not think you belong. You never felt you belonged in Dallas.
Well, I made my peace with Dallas. And, you know, one of the things that happened to me is that I don't want to say I took root in Dallas, but I came to live in Dallas in Texas, though not as a Texan. I'm a Northeasterner. I'm a Yankee. The landscapes I most favor, the family I most prize, everybody's back on I-95 or in the Berkshires up there. So I'm in the process of coming back there. But, you know, one of the things that Northerners, I think, fail to understand about the former Republic of Texas is that there's a lot of energy here. And though there's a kind of bad image of Texas, owing to all the obvious myths about Texas, it's really a wonderful place to be, in part because there's so much money here, and there's growth, and there's activity. The two things I don't like about Dallas are, first of all, hot weather. There is such a thing as reverse seasonal affective disorder. You know, we're aware of that mostly through people who go crazy in the winter. I don't like heat. I don't like sunshine. It debilitates. It tires. It makes me irritable. And so I much prefer northern climates and northern weather. That's kind of odd, but that's the way I am. And there are other people who share that opinion. The other thing I don't like is automobiles. And there are very few places in the country where you can live happily without a car. And I'm more than looking forward to getting rid of my car when I move back to Manhattan. And I'll suffer all of the indignities of the subway because I think it's more civil. This goes back to conversation. I think when you are on a street, walking around and talking to people, bumping up against people on a street, it's a much more cordial and civilized experience than sitting next to somebody at a traffic light with the windows rolled up in an air-conditioned car.
You have an essay in the book entitled Art, and as you mentioned, you write about the museum-going experience. And it seems in reading that essay that one of your big problems with going to museums is other people.
Sometimes it is. You know, museums are loud and crowded and noisy, and people are jostling you, and people are screaming. They're not using what our mothers called indoor voices. And if you want to look at a picture and people are pushing in front of you, it can be unpleasant. On the other hand, I've had great, surprising, unexpected, unplanned-for experiences where I've been the only person, not only in a room, but in a whole museum. And there's nothing better than that. It gives every aesthete something to look forward to. You know, most people are sort of shepherded through museums. They're wandering around aimlessly and listlessly. And you can see, I mean, people have done studies of this. How long does the average museum goer stand in front of a single picture? It's about 10 seconds at most. So they're sort of wandering around, waiting to get to the gift shop or the cafeteria or the next stop on the day's tourist trip.
You say you're looking forward to getting back to Manhattan, and yes. You write about Manhattan. What is your relationship with that city?
I am not a New Yorker by birth or by upbringing. I'm from Philadelphia. I grew up in suburban Philadelphia. I was educated in Massachusetts, on the eastern coast of Massachusetts, in the northwest corner of Massachusetts. You can figure out what places those might be.
Yes.
And I visited New York, and I have lived in New York for one whole year and parts of various stays here and there. But I gravitated to New York for what E.B. White, in his great essay, Here is New York, called the gifts of privacy and anonymity and the excitement of it. You know, a lot of people find that at a certain point it becomes too stressful to be in New York. I still like it. I love walking around. I walk 15 miles a day. I talk to people. People say New Yorkers are not friendly. I find that's entirely incorrect. New Yorkers are just as friendly as everybody else, especially people with dogs. If you want to, I mean, young people pick one another up because they make a point of talking to the other people about their dogs. I'm interested in the dogs, not the owners of the dogs. So I think Manhattan is just dandy. And if you have housing taken care of, that's a big if. If you have housing taken care of, Manhattan's a very cheap place to live because so much stuff is free.
Ultimately, what do you hope people get from your book?
Pleasure and wisdom.
And the wisdom regarding aging.
I suppose so. As I said at the beginning, I didn't intend to become old, and I didn't intend to write a book about being old, but apparently I did become old, and this is a book about my life. So it's about 70 years of my life. And, you know, essays are an interesting genre. An essay is not just something written for a very specific audience. It can be general. So there's no reason that a young person can't chuckle at my descriptions of life in a museum or think about what it's like to go to a high school reunion and be disappointed.
Well, the name of the new book is Senior Moments, Looking Back, Looking Ahead. It is published by FSG. Willard Spiegelman, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for sharing with us.
Thanks. You're welcome. It's been fun.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Senior Moments, Looking Back, Looking Ahead, published by FSG, by Willard Spiegelman. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.